This podcast is brought to you by AJ Bell and Shares Magazine. Shares Magazine is published by AJ Bell Media, part of AJ Bell.
Hi, my name is Dan Coatsworth, and this is episode 270-something of the AJ Bell Money and Markets podcast. And reliably told, it's the dog walker's choice for listening to chat about personal finance, business news, investing and more. So if you're walking your dog as you're listening, special shout out from us. But dog or no dog, we're very grateful, as always, that you're listening to the podcast. So let's get on with the show. Joining me this week is Danny Hewson. Hi there, Danny.
Hello, Dan. Yes, my dog is in another room, so he won't be interrupting us, although I do often listen to the Money and Markets podcast when I'm walking Biscuit. But today, it does seem like we're always bringing bad news, but we've got good news about the UK stock market. It can be an incredibly rare thing, but I promise you, it really is different this time. I'm going to be chatting about why the FTSE 100 has broken several records this week. What have been the key drivers behind that move?
Now, it's not intentional, but we do seem to be speaking about electric vehicles quite a lot on the podcast. And I guess this week is no exception, because we're going to be taking a look at the latest results from Tesla. And we've also got some interesting news on takeovers.
With news from JD Sports, Pepsi and Thames Water to cover off as well, you are getting a really good spread of companies on the podcast this week.
And we've got two of the writers from Shares Magazine on the show to do a deep dive into Associated British Foods, best known for owning Primark, but actually oversees lots more interesting stuff.
Don't miss a fascinating insight into first-time buyer trends and how the industry is hoping that the government might change its policies to help get more people on the property ladder.
Now, we're also going to have a little bit of news about account switching. Is there some interesting developments in the space? But first up, let's start with that good news, the FTSE 100 hitting record high. So, Danny, what happened? And I guess the key question is, why did it happen?
I'm going to take you through it bit by bit, because we're recording this on Wednesday morning, and it was Monday heading towards the close when it was like, it might just finish at a closing high. And indeed it did. 8,023 opening bell Tuesday. Again, we got then another record broken, an intraday high of 8,076. The previous record was from back in February 2023. And then this morning, again, we are dealing with the fact that the FTSE has opened at another intraday high, 8,083. Of course, a lot of volatility around, as ever, when we are talking about markets and macroeconomic news. You asked why, Dan. I mean, clearly that is on everybody's minds, because if they can figure out why, they can perhaps figure out whether or not the trend's going to continue. The big thing is the fact that we haven't seen the kind of escalation in the Middle East, which I think some investors were very wary about. So we had a very quiet weekend, and then, of course, we launch into Monday, and there's a lot of optimism there. We've also had the pound falling against the dollar. That is all, of course, to do with the expectation of when interest rate cuts might come. Bit more news on that to come. We've also then had, obviously, earnings season, and it's been really interesting to watch what's gone up and what's come down, because looking at today's big rises, a lot of them are actually yesterday's fallers and vice versa. So we had some really great performance from the likes of JD Sports, Ocado, Marks and Spencer yesterday. Today, they're down at the bottom, whereas miners that were really down at the bottom yesterday have come back up towards the top. So I think there's a lot of portfolio rebalancing going on. At the same time, there is sort of this expectation that the UK economy really is marching out of recession at quite a decent clip. We had PMI figures, which were looking really good for the service sector. But then, of course, wrapped into all that, if you've got an economy performing well, Dan, then clearly the big question is, do you need to cut interest rates? And actually, if you do cut interest rates, could that then see a return of our old friend inflation? And we know in the United States that's a big concern. And in fact, just at the same time that we're talking about maybe the interest rate cut from the Bank of England might not come as soon as investors think, that maybe August is too soon. In fact, maybe September is looking more likely, which kind of put the brakes on the rally for a short time. But then we had news out of the United States that there was a potential that the Fed might actually have to hike rates one more time. So that sort of set things going again. I mean, it feels at the moment, Dan, like we've got a foot on an accelerator at one point, then a foot on a brake, and then on the accelerator. And it's really hard for investors to know what to do.
That sounds a lot like my my driving skills. So I'm not quite sure which pedal to press, but...
Yeah. I'm teaching my daughter to drive at the moment, so I'm with you on that.
I mean, it is interesting. I mean, God, can you just imagine if there was an interest rate hike from the US? I mean, the markets would just go, this is completely the opposite of what we're expecting. I guess with, you know, the currency thing is quite an issue. With, you know, a weaker pound does benefit quite a lot of companies in the FTSE 100 because they, you know, three quarters of them earn overseas, and a good chunk of those will be earning in dollars. So when you translate it back into the pounds in which the share prices trade, that they get a boost there. But yeah, I mean, we can talk about interest rates till the cows come home, really. But it's I think what people need to think about is, like, don't try and time, you know, when these cuts will be happening. You know, have a good look at what these companies are doing. And a lot of the companies are actually coming out with some pretty good news, or at least, you know, worst case scenario, they're saying things, yeah, they're fairly resilient. You know, yes, we've got challenges in the market, but we're okay. We're getting on with things. We're getting on stuff. And importantly, a lot of them are getting on with their long-term growth plans. They are still investing. Whilst we've got job cuts here and there on the sides, they do have their eye on the longer term prize. And I think that's the way to run a business, isn't it? So you need to take that longer term view.
And it's been really interesting to sort of compare how the FTSE 100 has done with other indices. And of course, we know over the past couple of years when we've been talking on the podcast, we've been talking about the difference between the FTSE 100, the S&P and the NASDAQ, particularly because we don't have the sort of Magnificent Seven or the huge number of technology stocks, which have really been in vogue with investors over the past couple of years. And I had a look back 10 years and the NASDAQ is up 278% compared with where it was 10 years ago. The S&P 170%, the DAX 91, the CAC 40 81, the FTSE 100 just 20%. So that just shows how much room there is for the FTSE 100 to really sort of accelerate now, to catch up. You know, we've spoken a lot on this podcast as well about the fact that a lot of UK companies look undervalued at the moment. Huge opportunities for investors from the United States to come in and snap them up. And that is something which we have seen happen a lot. But then looking at the FTSE's performance this year, it's up almost 5% since the start of the year. And when you compare that with the S&P, up almost 7%, it feels like now that these two markets are kind of getting back to a sort of more equal playing field. But, you know, there is a long way to go for the FTSE to make up some of the miles that it's lost.
Yeah, I think you also need to think about perspective of having a diversified portfolio. So if you've got, you know, US has been fantastic for a very long time. But equally, if things start to get, you know, quite negative, what goes up quite quickly could come down quite quickly. There have been times over the last 10, 15 years where, you know, the FTSE 100 has held its own quite well in more difficult markets. And I think that you've got quite a lot, you know, a lot of sort of companies in there that, you know, they may have slower growth, but they also have resilience. And I think that's really important. So when you're, you know, you're trying to plan for your long term, grow your wealth, you've got to think about, you know, what might happen when times go wrong? Do I have any sort of buoyancy in my portfolio? And it's in times like this, actually, when those elements of the FTSE 100 do sort of shine through. But yeah, it's. I mean, we're recording this slightly earlier than normal on Wednesday, when we've got tech companies are going to be delivering a lot of news over the next week or so in the US. And I mean, that could easily, the messaging from them is very important. We're going to talk about Tesla in a second, but I think obviously we can do a roundup next week's on podcast about what some of the other tech companies are saying. But if there's sort of a common theme and they're finding a life a bit harder, they could have a really big influence on the direction of the US stock market. And of course, if the US stock market starts to come back a little bit, unfortunately, it does affect the rest of the world. Everyone sort of seems to look at the US as sort of the benchmark for what's going on, and that does affect investor sentiment. But I think, yeah, generally, it's great that we can bring some good news on the UK stock market for once.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, massive valuations on some of these stocks in particular. So what's really interesting is the weight of expectation about particularly these so-called Magnificent Seven. But two of them in particular, and I know we're talking about Tesla in just a sec, because that is one that has been underperforming, but so has Apple. And actually, just yesterday, we got some details about iPhone sales in China, which have slumped once again. So it kind of feels, I know a lot of commentators in the United States are now sort of saying, well, maybe it's not the Magnificent Seven, maybe it's the Fab Five. So, you know, fortunes can change, as you say, on the edge of a pin, really. And when you've got these huge valuation, there is expectation from investors that these companies will keep delivering above expectation. And even if they meet expectation, that might not be enough to maintain investor sentiment. But for Tesla, Dan, I mean, the writing has been on the wall. Everyone was expecting this latest earnings update to be a stinker, and it was. And yet, we saw the shares rise afterwards. What's going on there?
Yeah. I mean, so you're looking at about a 40% decline up in the share price year to date up until those results came out. It's not hard to see why. The company is saying one day, we're going to have to lay off 10% of our workforce. Then it's saying we're cutting the price of our cars. Then we're cutting them again. But clearly, the electric vehicle industry is highly competitive. Loads more people are offering stuff. And against this backdrop, you've got people watching their finances. You know, the interest rates are staying high, which means you've got to, when you've got a big ticket item like buying an electric vehicle, it's a real considered purchase. So, you're not going to rush into that. So poor old, I don't say poor old Tesla, but Tesla has seen a more difficult environment. So it's come out with these results. It said actually profits have more than halved over the last year. And so it's you're thinking, okay, well, that seems understandable, because if it's cutting prices, that sort of suggests its profit margins are being squeezed. So the key question here is, why has that share price gone up? Yeah, so as we're recording this in pre-market trading, it's really racing ahead. And what it is, it's come out and said, well, actually, we were planning some new vehicles, but we're going to bring that forward, and they're going to be launched much sooner than you think. And not only will this range include some, in their language, affordable — it might not be affordable to everyone, but affordable in Tesla terms — we're also going to use the existing factories to build them. That means we don't have to spend loads of money to build new factory lines. We can use everything that we've got already. They've probably got a bit of spare capacity if demand for their sort of current range is a bit weaker. And so, really, the market is excited again. But, we don't have a lot of information about what these new vehicles are. So there is a sort of an element here of a rebound, because sentiment was so weak towards Tesla going into those results. I guess the acid test is, can it bounce back? it's a real Marmite stock. But it just feels to me like they've gone from being at this first mover advantage, say five years ago, 10 years ago, with what they were trying to do. Now, so many companies offer this thing. Is it a badge of honor to own a Tesla? I don't know. I think I see so many electric vehicles on the road now, and the percentage of our Tesla is quite small.
Yeah, and it's been interesting because some people don't see it as a badge of honor owning a Tesla anymore. In fact, they see it as an embarrassment. And there's been lots of stuff on social media about that. And that is something that Tesla's going to have to get over. And it was really interesting listening to some of the Q&A after the results were announced, because Elon Musk wasn't really prepared to be drawn on these plans for these more affordable models. And it kind of felt like maybe he'd sort of drawn out the plans on a packet of a cigarette packet, assuming that you can still get packets of cigarettes where he is in the States. Well, obviously you can, but whether he smokes or not, I don't know. But it was just really interesting to see how little meat he was adding to the bone. It felt like he was chucking a bone at investors because they'd been clamoring for one. There'd been this report from Reuters that the Model 2 had been scrapped, and this is the model circa $25,000, which I don't know about you, Dan, but that still seems like an awful lot for a car. And these new, more affordable models, they've already cautioned investors that they're not likely to be in that $25,000 range. They're going to be more expensive because they have to be built on those existing lines. So I think there are an awful lot of hard yards that Tesla is going to have to try and walk over the next year. And of course, at the same time, you know, a lot of investors have been really concerned about the fact that Elon Musk's attention has been split so many different ways, particularly with X. He spends a lot of time on X at the moment, stoking up controversy. And he has a pay deal that he's trying to get through. So he is appealing to investors saying, look, I am here. I am sitting behind the desk. I am doing these hard yards. You should give me this amount of pay because I am worth it. But we'll see how investors vote on that one.
Yeah. Should we talk about tracksuits and trainers? another sort of a repeat theme on the podcast. We do talk about tracksuits and trainers quite a lot. So JD Sports is it's got a position in America, but it wants to be much bigger in the country, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, it has said that it wants to be like this global sportswear giant. And it has already set about really sort of grabbing more and more market share. And I was quite interested to find that in terms of its revenue, its turnover already 32% comes from the United States. But clearly, it's still quite a small player in that market. So it's bought up US rival Hibbett's. The deal is valued at $878 million. Now, Hibbett's has just over 1,000 stores in 36 states in the United States. So immediately that gives JD Sports some great big shop windows, which will be able to sort of draw in the American consumer, try to make it more of a household name, because certainly in the United States, they like what they know. So this potentially could boost turnover in the US to 40%. Now, along with that, something which I think investors always like to hear is when a takeover comes with cost cutting already built in. So it's reckoning that it can achieve savings of about $25 million because of this deal. So shares have been pretty suppressed over the last few months, certainly since the start of the year. And they rose 6% on the news of this deal. So I think it has gone down very well with investors. But just while we're talking about sportswear and trainers, I was talking about Tesla on New Zealand radio this morning. And the one thing that they wanted to talk about beforehand was our UK politicians and their love of Adidas, because apparently Keir Starmer has been spotted in a pair of gazelles.
Yeah, and it is true, isn't it? Because Rishi Sunak was spotted in some trainers, and I saw these articles about how you can look like Rishi. whether you want to or not is another thing, but I'm not sure
Adidas is gonna go with UK politicians for their next brand ambassadors.
No, I don't think so. But on the subject of takeovers, just a quickie on I just wanted to talk about the amount of money you get paid. Like, if you own a share in a company and then they receive a takeover bid, typically, I always used to think that you'd get like 20 or 30% above the market prices as sort of the premium for this takeover. Last year in the UK, it was just over 50% that we saw with London listed takeovers. This week, we've had a couple of deals, one in the UK, one in America, where you got triple digit premiums, which is, you know, this is like totally unheard of. So there's a big property company called CoStar, and they bought the UK listed real estate portal On the Market fairly recently. They've come in and offered $1.6 billion to buy this digital real estate services group called Matterport. They were offering 216% premium to buy that company, which is like, it's like, you know, they must be very serious about buying it. But actually, if you look at it, you know, Matterport share price has been absolutely hammered. So whilst that may seem like a massive premium, someone that's owned those shares for a couple of years is still not getting back what they probably paid a few years ago. In the UK, we've got a mining company called Base Resources. They've had a takeover offer at 188% premium to the previous sort of trading day's closing price.
Wow.
So if you think, yeah, I mean, if you think that you own a share, you might expect to make, say, you know, anything between 5 and 10% in a good year return on a share. If you're getting something close to 200%, it's like so much of your future gains have been brought forward and given to you. So you think, okay, this is fantastic. but I think the key thing here is don't expect that to be the norm. Certainly not quite the case. Let's talk Pepsi, because they had results out. It's quite a bit, you know, known as PepsiCo on the stock market. How did they fare with their latest figures?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about Pepsi because we've done a lot about volumes and the fact that obviously a lot of these big brands over the past couple of years have been able to very successfully pass on price hikes to the consumers, and the likes of Coke and Pepsi haven't really seen those price hike dent sales volumes up until now. And Pepsi shares fell on the news. And it was quite interesting because in terms of revenues, it beat expectations. It beat the street. You know, it was still doing incredibly well in terms of sales, particularly international sales. But volumes in the US fell substantially. So we had the boss talking about this. This is the CEO, Ramon Laguarta, and he was saying that the issue for Pepsi was some of the lower earners in the United States. Those consumers had really been impacted by those price hikes, and prices were up 6% over the year. Volumes in the United States down 5%. And he was saying that he was hyper aware that this was an issue, something that they were going to have to focus on. Now prices were normalizing, and particularly that demographic, he's concerned about sort of the snacks like Cheetos, that's a big one, and Fritos and that kind of thing. So hyper aware that a lot of households have been trading down. They might still buy, you know, the odd one or two, but they're going to be then looking to try and make their cash stretch that bit further. And as with an awful lot of manufacturers that have sort of begun to lose volumes, they're now having to think about how to win back those consumers with innovations, with offers, with clever marketing campaigns that really potentially bring people back. So I think it's going to be one to watch with an awful lot of consumer giants over the next couple of earnings quarters.
I must just give you a little recommendation. I know we're not in the sort of usually in the habit of recommending other people, you know, what stuff to consume. But there's a series at the moment on Channel 4 about super brands, and they had one a couple of weeks ago on PepsiCo. Now, a lot of people don't realise Pepsi owns Walker's Crisps, and that was a sort of the key focus of the show. But you can go onto Channel 4 website and you can watch it and catch up. It's absolutely fascinating. There's an excellent one as well about Kellogg's, and they're talking about the cereal industry. So totally worth it. You're talking about marketing, clever marketing. You know, the stuff they do to market crisps and the history of it is so fascinating. So let's just before we finish up on what's been happening in the markets, we want to talk quickly about Thames Water. It's not actually on the stock market, but it's been grabbing people's attention, partly because Elliot, the activist investor that has been involved in lots of companies on the stock market recently, is seeing an opportunity. So Danny, quickly, what's been going on with Thames Water?
Yeah, really interesting, because of course we know that it owes a huge amount of money. Well, certainly its parent company does. We know that it has failed to pay bondholders interest that they are owed. It's got debt payments due to a number of banks as well. Bit of a ticking clock, really. So this week we've had an updated business plan from Thames Water saying that it wants to charge its customers an additional 44% for the pleasure in order to continue to invest in infrastructure, but also to continue to be able to deliver the service. Now, Ofwat's going to be taking a look at this. It makes a decision later in the year. It would take bills to over £600 a year by 2030. So there's been a lot of focus on whether or not customers should foot the bill, where dividend payments have gone, why so much debt has been heaped on the company, and a lot of its current investors saying that the company is uninvestable. And yet, here we have Elliott investors, incredibly well-known activist investors, buying up bonds, suggesting that perhaps the market has been too pessimistic about the potential future of Thames Water. So it's going to be fascinating to see how that progresses. Have they made a good bet? Have they made a bad bet? I don't know, Dan, what do you think?
Well, it's a brave person to go in and trying to snap up an investment vehicle. You can call a bond an investment vehicle in a sort of a company that's all over the headlines, but it's basically saying its parents in dire straits. But I guess this is how they make money, isn't it? This is the risks that they take. If they get it wrong, they lose lots of money. If they get it right, could be quids in, but I don't think the average person would be rushing to invest in anything linked to Thames Water, given all the negativity that we're seeing at the moment. Should we turn our attention to the property market? I saw some reports from the Building Society Association just about what's been going on with first time buyers, and it actually sort of ties in with a few quite interesting things. There was something that recently came out from the Resolution Foundation, said that if you go back to 1997, the most common living arrangement for an adult aged between 18 and 34 was that you were a couple and you were living with children. Now that age group, it's you're living with your parents. I mean, I think a lot of people, a lot of people go, perhaps they go off to university and they come back and live with the parents again just while they're getting their feet, maybe in their first job. But, in your 30s, you think, okay, there's stuff, for most people thinking, that's not an aspiration I want to do, is to still be living with my parents. But unfortunately for a lot of people, that's reality now. You just can't do it. So what we've seen from this latest report from the BSA is that 12 years in a row, the biggest barrier to buying a property was actually raising a deposit. But it all changed in 2022 as interest rates started to go up. And since then, it's not been able to afford repayments. So if you look at the trend, the chart, there's a chart from the BSA, it suggests this is about to revert back to norm as mortgages are becoming cheaper. There's lots of calls like thinking, how can we, what's needed to get first-time buyers on the property ladder? I think at the moment you've got, according to Nationwide, does some research into this, one in five people expect to wait until at least their 40s before they can buy a home. And more than half are actually willing to completely relocate to a different part of the country in order to be able to afford a home. I mean, that's quite shocking, really, isn't it? I think most people would prefer to stay if they know an area. They just think, where can I go? I mean, maybe they can travel sort of a few miles outside if they live in the city or something. But going something completely new simply to buy a property, that's quite a jump. So, I mean, the BSA is called on. It's got a big list of recommendations for policy changes. It thinks the government should have a proper good look at this, revise the planning system, reform taxation, look at the sort of the affordability of the private rented sector. But I think, what some other stuff is, you also catch your attention, is that the Nationwide is basically saying, it's time to bring back the Help to Buy ISA. And also in doing so, you have to increase the amount that can be saved per month from £200 to £500. And actually, that's reflective of sort of the higher house prices that we see today. And that could potentially open up some more options for first-time buyers. But I think it's you've got this situation where I think lenders are sort of saying, well, actually, we're only allowed to lend out a certain percentage of our money to first-time buyers. We want to be able to help more people, of course, but that would, how can we support people with lower incomes, less wealth? They see an opportunity because demand is there. So there's all, you've got this massive sort of smorgasbord of suggestions, policy changes, tax changes, incentives to come. And it's just really, it's quite hard to get your head around. But I think, it goes back to anyone who's perhaps listening to this podcast and thinking, how on earth am I going to get on this property ladder? I mean, Danny, how did you manage to buy your first flat or your first house?
My husband and I, we were not married at the time, but we got 100% mortgage. We didn't need to save up for a deposit. I've only ever bought one house. I'm still in it. So it was 20 years ago that we bought the place. We spent a lot of money doing it up. But yeah, we didn't have any deposit to put down. And to be honest with you, because I was living in London at the time, my husband was living up in the north, and then I moved back, and that's when we bought the house. We were paying two lots of rent, two different places, two lots of bills. So in order to have been able then to afford to buy a house together, we'd have had to maybe move in with my parents, or certainly batten down the hatches for a couple of years, whereas we were able just to jump straight in and do it then and there. So, yeah, I do think that there's an awful lot that does need to be done, because the prospect of my kids coming back from university and then living with us for another 10 years, no, I'm not up for that. How about you, Dad? How did you buy your house?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I was with who is now my wife. The two of us were, we spent a couple of years just squirreling money away, just saving. And we've got it was about, I think, a 90% mortgage. Interestingly, at the time, we could have got 110% mortgage. It was in that era where banks were happy to lend more than the value of the property, saying, yeah, you might want to splash on a bit of DIY and stuff. I'm really glad that we didn't do that. And I know people who did go down that route, and of course they found it quite hard. And we bought a house, lived in it 5 years, ended up selling it for less than what we paid, because I think we just bought the top of the market as well, which is not really a great start. I think at the time we thought, okay, this is all expensive. But I look back now and thinking, crikey, if it was my children are too young to, they're still at school, but it's like, imagine when they're ready to buy, it's going to be, so hard. And you can understand why everyone talks about the bank of mum and dad having to lean on the parents to help you. And I just can't see another way at the moment to get them to start renting. You've got people, landlords saying, we need, it's not just a case of, pay a 4-week deposit. It's like, pay months and months worth of rent up front, competition to get on the board. So yeah, it's a struggle thing. So obviously next week we've got David Hollingworth from London and Country coming on the podcast next week, and he's going to talk about mortgages, and so we can talk to him a bit more about what he's seeing with first time buyers as well. So just a little trail to make sure, don't miss that one. But we've had quite a lot of you get in touch to say you really like the deep dives into companies and investment trusts that the writers of Shares Magazine have been doing recently. So we've now got Tom Sieber and Ian Conway to come on this week's show. They're going to talk about a company which saw its market value jump by nearly £2 billion on Tuesday after investors lapped up its latest results. And I'm talking here about Associated British Foods. You might know it for owning Primark, but actually look under the bonnet and it actually got a lot of other stuff, which is really interesting. And these other things are very important for its profit growth. So to tell us a bit more, here's Tom and Ian.
It's fair to say Associated British Foods, which would probably be best known to a wider audience as the owner of Primark, smashed the lights out with its recent first quarter update. The shares extending their gains over the last 12 months to more than 30%, despite what has been a pretty tricky backdrop for retail. Primark was a big contributor to its success, but there's a lot more to the business than just the budget clothing chain, right, Ian?
Yes, Tom, you're right. You're right. It's a £20 billion business now, and £2 billion of those gains came yesterday when the firm reported its interim results. But it's five businesses, ranging from grocery, which is about just under a quarter of sales, to food ingredients, agriculture, sugar. Each of those is about 10% of the business, so you've got just over 50% there. And then the Primark business is another 45, 46%.
Yeah, and if you look at the grocery business, there's some pretty well-known brands in there, aren't there? The sort of Twinings Tea, Ryvita. You know, they're staples of people's cupboards at home.
Yeah, very well-known brands. And also in the ingredients business, it's not so popular here, but Mazola is hugely popular in the States, for example.
And it's unusual, you know, in having that conglomerate structure, right?
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about in today's world, it's all about breaking businesses up. And when you say conglomerate, your mind tends to go back to 1980s. You think of things like Hanson Trust and British and Commonwealth. And then there was that real, in the 90s, there was that real move to sort of take these businesses apart, split them all up. And there's undoubtedly been a lot of pressure on the Western family over the years to do that. But they've always resisted it. And when you get results like we've just had, where all five businesses are firing on, you know, all cylinders, you can see why, because they're decent businesses. And actually, there isn't a need to break it up.
Yeah, you mentioned the Western family there. They hold a controlling stake in the business. Perhaps it's worth touching on the background a little bit, the history of the business, the Western family's involvement and kind of how it's developed into, you know, what it is today.
Yeah, it's interesting because Garfield Western, the guy who set it up, was actually Canadian. He fought in the First World War for the Canadian Army and then settled in England afterwards. And in the mid-30s, his family were bakers back in Canada. And in the mid-30s, he got a small amount of money together and he got together seven small bakeries and formed what he called Allied Bakeries. And from there it grew. You mentioned Ryvita. Yeah, just after the Second World War, they bought Ryvita. And today they own Kingsmill, Jordan's, the guys who make the cereal bars, Dorset Cereals, Silver Spoon, and a bunch of other brands. In the 50s, they expanded into Australia and New Zealand. And then in the early 60s, it became the group we know today. It became Associated British Foods. But the grocery business was interesting too, because here's another name, a blast from the past, Fine Fare. They owned Fine Fare in the early 60s.
And that is interesting.
I think you're too young for that one.
Maybe. I didn't want to say that, but yeah.
Some of our listeners will definitely remember. You might remember Summerfield, who bought Fine Fare. Yeah, another blast from the past. And eventually that was all sold off to Tesco. And they used the money to buy British Sugar, which is a big part of the business today. As I say, it makes about 12% of sales, about a similar percentage of profit. But you're right, everybody knows AB Foods for Primark, and that's kind of what all the excitement was about yesterday.
Yeah, so let's go into a bit more detail on that. What really came across in the results about Primark and what has been going so well for that business?
Well, there's a couple of things. Firstly, as you say, it's been a really tricky retail environment, but these guys are they're not holding back. You know, they opened another 9 stores in the first half of its financial year to March. So it's now got 432 stores. They're opening another in another country. They're going to be open in Hungary later this year. That'll be 16 countries across Europe and the US. And that's been a big contributor to growth. So top line was up 7.5% to £4.5 billion. That's just over 50% of the group total. But 5.4% of that 7.5% was from new stores. Only 2%, just over 2%, was like-for-like growth. So higher prices mainly. Average basket size, they say, shrank slightly. They had a cracking Christmas, and actually wet weather. Now you'll see a lot of firms complain about wet weather, but that was the wet, damp weather we've been having. It's been very good for Primark because they stock a lot of knitwear and a lot of outdoorsy clothes too. So those ranges sold well. They were able to charge full price, and that fed through into operating profits. They were up to 500 million, and that's one of the big surprises. Analysts hadn't expected operating profits to be quite so strong.
Absolutely. I mean, another thing to talk about, I suppose, is the online strategy at Primark. It's really something of an outlier in the retail sector, and you know, for a long time resisting having any online presence at all. But what they have done, it seems to be working, right?
Yeah, I mean, we've been wondering what they would do online because the firm's always said, look, the unit cost of our products is so low, we're not going to do online. We're not going to do like ASOS, for example, because and handling all the returns and so on. It's not going to be a moneymaker for us.
No, sure.
So they've been trialing click and collect in their stores, and it's been hugely successful. They say it's meeting an unfulfilled demand from new and existing customers because they can order stuff that's not in their local Primark. So if you see something online, you think, oh, fancy that.
Yeah.
It's not in your local branch. You can order it, it gets delivered to your local branch. So they've tapped an unfulfilled demand. They kind of knew it was there all the time, but didn't know how to tap into it. They're getting good basket sizes. And they're getting top-up sales when people go into the store to collect what they're
Yeah.
ordering. So
Yeah.
people are actually buying more stuff. And this is really interesting. I'll read you what they said. We believe we've developed a bespoke version of e-commerce that is additive to our store-led model, enhances our overall digital engagement program, and delivers incremental sales. And this is huge. Because when Next went digital in 2017, it had a dramatic impact on in-store sales.
So
And
sort
if
of
you read,
cannibalizing the in-store sales with the online sales there.
absolutely. And they go into this in a lot of detail, actually, in the annual report, which they released in March. And I would always encourage people to read the annual reports for, you know, stocks that they own or. Next has always, as you know, been very good at setting out its strategy and its
Yeah.
capital allocation
Very
program.
transparent, yeah.
But you'll get lots of interesting little nuggets. And they say 1999 to 2017 was plain sailing. All we did was open new stores, add more products, and add more directory customers. And it was all hugely cash generative. They returned something like £4.5 billion of cash to shareholders. But from 2017, once they launched their online business, it completely cannibalized their in-store business. So they say, with every new online sale, there were additional variable costs. And with every lost retail sale, the dead weight of rent, rates, and other fixed costs grew heavier. And yet it seems that Primark have managed to, you know, find the Holy Grail. They've not only got a model that doesn't cannibalize their in-store sales, it actually increases them. And I think this is probably the most exciting thing
Yeah.
about that earnings report. That's probably why the market got quite so excited. So earnings were better. Yes, you're going to get upgrades from the analysts, mostly in the range of 5% to earnings per share. But I think if Primark really has discovered how to increase in-store sales via e-commerce, that's huge, you know, for the
Absolutely. Yeah,
business
and I
going
think
forwards.
you could say really that the business is being rewarded for daring to be a bit different. You know, it is a conglomerate structure, which is different. It's done it's had a different kind of online strategy from a lot of the peer group. And that, you know, like you said, appears to be paying off now. And I think it's moved on from being that kind of, you know, the term was Primarni, wasn't it? You know, it was very disposable fashion, kind of, you know, people buying very, very cheap clothes, throwing, you know, the floor covered in discarded clothes. You know, it's not necessarily like that anymore. It's, you know, people buying kids' clothes. It's slightly higher quality, but still very affordable. And I think, you know, they've put themselves in a really good place. So interesting to see what's to come.
Yeah, I mean, I think they categorize themselves as providing quality essentials and affordable fashion. And I think essentials is the real thing. You know, nowadays when people are struggling to get by, maybe you've got to be selling what people essentials. And actually, clothing is an essential. It's not a nice to have. You know, we all need to go and get new clothes every now and then. And as I say, over the winter, this poor weather's been that they've played it very, very well.
Absolutely.
That was Tom Sieber and Ian Conway from Shares Magazine. Now there's time for one more item for this podcast. What you got, Dan?
Well, I think it was a couple of weeks ago. It's probably longer, but Laura was on previously talking about switching bank accounts. And if you do so, quite a lot of the banking providers were offering like an incentive. So it's if you're thinking, okay, maybe I either don't like my current bank or thinking, well, you know, there's no reason to stay loyal. And if I move, I might get a little, you know, a little boost. So First Direct was offering £175, which is, you know, that's a nice little way of getting, you know, essentially a bit of free money. It launched, you know, probably a month ago, but it's just disappeared. And it's not the only one. So what we're seeing here is that if you're seeing free cash offers for switching accounts, and you're actually thinking hard about doing it, you might want to jump on them quickly because they are vanishing very fast. So, you know, you've had banks like HSBC, NatWest, Lloyds, Santander, all of them have recently ended some of their offers of cash to switch. And, you know, some of them are offering as much as £200. I think this is, it's a bit like the ever we talk about interest rates changing, expectations for interest rates changing all the time. Because as these expectations change, you've got one day you might see a really good rate on a cash savings account. Well, that can just disappear like that. So you do need to have to act fast if you see something that looks quite good for savings or banking. And it's kind of the opposite thing. We say if you see something when investing and then they sort of say act quickly, you know, that's a red flag. But with banking saving here, if you've got incentives to do something, you know, you do want to look fast. And so actually, we are seeing that in a related sort of activity, there's a lot of activity going on with transferring balances on credit cards here. And actually, £1.8 billion worth of credit card balance transfers were recorded in January. And that's the highest value we've seen since February 2005. So I think what we're hearing, you have plenty of offers that have been going on with credit card providers to move rates. And I think a lot of people are thinking, well, crikey, I've got quite a bit of outstanding balance on my credit card. I don't like the current rates. If I can move to someone, I can potentially get this more manageable way of trying to repay the borrowings on a credit card. And if we can get the rate down, obviously that's very helpful. So there are lots going on there. But yeah, just sort of, you know, quickly flag that one. Something to bear in mind if you are thinking about, you know, looking at your personal finances and trying to get them a bit more into sort of a more manageable shape.
Thank you, Dan. That is all we have time for this week. As Dan says, next week we've got David Hollingworth from London and Country on the podcast talking about the latest trends on the mortgage market. And we're also going to have someone from JP Morgan's Mercantile Investment Trust to talk about finding opportunities among mid and large cap stocks on the UK stock market in the light of the FTSE hitting a record high this week. Until then, thanks for listening.
Before you go, please remember this podcast is for educational purposes, and the views expressed don't necessarily reflect those of AJ Bell or Shares Magazine. The podcast isn't telling you if a certain investment is suitable or not. Don't forget that the value of investments can change, and you can lose money as well as make it. It's also important to remember that how you're taxed will depend on your individual circumstances, and rules can change. The way an investment performed in the past may not be the same as how it behaves in the future. If you want help, go see a qualified financial advisor.